Well, this morning we're taking a break from Matthew's Gospel, and if you have a Bible then turn again please to the passage that we read, 1 Peter chapter 5. And those of you who come to time out will know that we looked at these last few verses of 1 Peter a few weeks ago, and I hope you don't mind if we return to those verses this morning. So our passage is this last section of Peter's first epistle, 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 to 14. And there are four things then that I would like us to notice in this passage. And first of all, the Christian endures trials. That's our first heading. The Christian endures trials. So if there's one theme that dominates 1 Peter more than any other, I guess it's probably the theme of suffering, whether it's the genuineness of our faith being tested by trials in chapter 1, or following Christ's example in non-retaliation in chapter 2, or being reviled for our good behaviour in chapter 3, or judgment beginning in the house of God in chapter 4. Again and again, from a variety of angles, suffering is in view. Explicit references to suffering occur twice in these verses that we're looking at this morning. And I want to suggest that when Peter begins here describing his readers as under the mighty hand of God there in verse 6, that too is a reference to their suffering. Because you see, in Peter's thinking, whatever the immediate source of a Christian's suffering might be, the ultimate source is God. That idea is anathema to much of modern evangelicalism. A Christian woman is diagnosed with cancer, and almost before she's home from her hospital appointment, her pastor and her Christian friends are assuring her, this isn't God's doing, you know. She mustn't think that he has willed this. She mustn't think that he is complicit in this turn of events. Much of modern evangelicalism is horrified at the thought that God would deliberately send suffering into his people's lives. But Peter isn't horrified by that thought. He refers without a hint of embarrassment back in chapter 4, verse 19, to suffering according to God's will. And I'm saying then that this idea in chapter 5, verse 6 of being under the mighty hand of God means suffering under the mighty hand of God. That specifically is what Peter is talking about. But notice that Peter here isn't merely stating a fact about his readers. He isn't merely stating that they are presently under God's mighty hand, that they are presently suffering. No, he's not merely stating a fact. He's actually issuing a command. Humble yourselves, he says. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. What does he mean? Well, he means accept the suffering that you're experiencing. Submit to it. Endure these trials that you're going through. Humble yourselves under God's mighty hand. Now, is he saying that it's wrong to try to avoid suffering in the Christian life? No, where suffering may be righteously avoided, that is, where it may be avoided at no cost to our Christian integrity, it should be avoided. There's certainly nothing intrinsically good about suffering. But often, of course, suffering can't be righteously avoided. The disdain and insults that were just part of daily life for Peter's readers because they were living in a pagan society, they couldn't be righteously avoided. Often suffering can't. And Peter is saying then, in such circumstances, don't chafe at God's will for your life. Don't get all wound up and frustrated and indignant about what God is doing, the way he's messing you around. Don't get into a big strop saying, it's not fair, God. This shouldn't be happening to me. Rather, he says, humble yourselves. Humble yourselves under God's mighty hand. I think there's actually an expression within the passage of the kind of thing that Peter means. Look at verse 11, which we can easily overlook, where Peter writes, "To him be the dominion forever and ever." Well, it's just a throwaway little doxology of the kind that do litter these New Testament epistles, is it not? Well, no, I don't think it is. The word translated dominion can mean dominion, or it can mean power or strength. And here are Peter's readers then. And they're suffering. And they're suffering because of the will of God. And more than that, God possesses infinite strength and could, if he so pleased, in a stroke, sweep all their suffering away. But he's not doing so. He's not deploying his strength in that way. And remarkably, in verse 11, Peter is giving his readers a doxology with which to worship the divine strength that isn't being deployed to remove their suffering. That's what he means by humbling themselves under the mighty hand of God. And it's hard then, isn't it? It's profoundly counterintuitive. What Peter is talking about here, this enduring of trials, this taking it on the chin when God is sending suffering our way, even adoring his strength that so conspicuously isn't delivering us or relieving us, that is something that I'm sure all of us struggle with, which is why we must hasten on to what Peter says next. So our first heading this morning, the Christian endures trials. But then notice secondly, the Christian expects glory. The Christian expects glory. Because you see, this humbling of ourselves under God's mighty hand, this willingness to accept and endure trials, it isn't some kind of stoical detachment where we train our emotions into a state of numb indifference to pain and adversity. Nor is it some kind of superficial, feigned cheerfulness. You may remember back in the summer, it seems a long time ago now, but the Conservative Party was having its leadership contest. And eventually then the contest became a two-horse race between Jeremy Hunt and Boris Johnson. And on the day that the winner was to be announced, there was a large televised gathering at the Conservative Party headquarters. And the two contestants were first told privately backstage who had won, the result of the contest. They were then given a few moments to settle themselves before appearing before this gathered audience where the result would be publicly announced. And as they entered the room then to applause and to the handshakes and hugs of family and friends on the front row, they weren't supposed to spoil the public announcement that was about to be made. They weren't supposed to give any indication which of them was the winner and which of them was the loser. And so there was Jeremy Hunt, knowing that he had lost the contest, inwardly no doubt reeling with disappointments, and yet as he walked into that room, he had this kind of beaming smile plastered across his face. It was a superficial, feigned cheerfulness. That's not what Peter is talking about. No, this humble endurance of trials that he describes, it's the result of having a confident, powerful hope. It's the effect of looking forward to the world to come. It's the consequence of expecting glory. Look at what he says. He says, "Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you." And you might be thinking, but Dan, aren't you reading a lot into this exaltation that Peter mentions? Interpreting it as glory, as what awaits us in the world to come. Isn't Peter merely referring to a temporal exaltation, perhaps? An exaltation within this life? A point in a few months' time or a few years' time when present difficulties will pass and things will get easier? Isn't that the meaning of this phrase? Well, no, I don't think it is, for two reasons. First, it's a matter of simple observation, is it not? that for many suffering believers, there's no exaltation, no respite even, ever transpires in this life. In the case of Peter's first readers, it wasn't that they were in the midst of some extraordinary crisis facing an unusually vicious Roman emperor or something, in which case things might significantly improve a bit further down the line. No, as I said before, they were just experiencing the daily reality of disdain and insults because they were living in a pagan society, and that wasn't going to improve. The pagans weren't suddenly going to wake up one morning with a much sunnier disposition toward their Christian neighbours. No, disdain and insult from the pagans would be a lifelong phenomenon. And then secondly, the point that Peter makes here in the second half of verse 6, he repeats in verse 10. There he doesn't use the word exalt, but he again describes the believer's suffering being followed by something altogether different and better. After the suffering, the believer will be restored, confirmed, strengthened, and established. And in verse 10, it's made pretty clear that that is a reference to something beyond this life, something indeed beyond history itself, because notice Peter emphasizes it's the one who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ who will restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. The implication being that it's in the act of restoring, confirming, strengthening, and establishing you that God will bestow on you eternal glory. And so I'm saying then, verses 6 and 10 both set forth this pattern of present suffering succeeded by everlasting bliss. And it's the prospect of the everlasting bliss that enables and animates the submission to the present suffering. And so I want to ask you this morning, as a Christian, are you expecting glory? I mean by that, are you expecting it the same way that many children just now are expecting Christmas morning? Is it a big deal to you? Are you excitedly expecting it? Because it's that kind of expectation of glory that makes a man or woman able to humbly endure trials. The four verbs that Peter uses at the end of verse 10 are very interesting. The first, translated restore in the ESV, it refers to repairing something that's broken. It's used of Jesus' first fishermen disciples sitting in their boats mending their fishing nets, those torn and damaged nets. They were mending them. And then the other three verbs, translated confirm, strengthen, and establish in the ESV, they all have very similar meanings. They're all to do with making something really robust and solid. And together then, these verbs convey, I think, two distinct aspects of what God is going to do for us on the day that he bestows eternal glory. He's going to first repair us. These bodies and minds of ours that took such a battering throughout our lives and then were finished off completely in death, he's going to wonderfully mend them in resurrection. But secondly, he's not only going to mend us the way that you might mend something in your house, a kitchen drawer or something with a bit of super glue, knowing full well you'll have to repeat the job in a few weeks' time. No, he's going to make us so robust and strong that we'll never break again. Remember how Peter has described us human beings in our present state back in chapter 1, verse 24. He's quoting, of course, from Isaiah. And he says, all flesh is like grass, all its glory like the flower of grass. The grass withers and the flower falls. In other words, we are fragile. We are like delicate little blades of grass. But we won't be in the world to come. We will then be like great, sturdy cedars of Lebanon, in body and in mind, invulnerable and indefatigable. It's a truly thrilling prospect. And do you see then how such an expectation enables endurance of present trials? Observing Fraser this past week, I was reflecting on my own experiences at primary school during the last week before the Christmas holidays, and it would be perhaps the penultimate day, and the teacher would spur us on to get our maths or English or whatever done by saying things like, come on, get all this work done now, and then tomorrow it will be the Christmas party. Now, the logic of those words was completely lost on me, because I hated Christmas parties. In terms of the horrors of school life, Christmas parties probably came second to school trips, but it was a pretty close run thing. The idea of playing ridiculous games all day and eating tacky party food, it just held no attraction for me whatsoever. And I couldn't see then how the prospect of that tomorrow was an encouragement to keep going with maths and English today. Peter's logic here doesn't suffer from that same flaw. Perhaps this morning you're suffering. Your body has some disease. Or your mind's unwell. Or you're just struggling in the grip of exhaustion or in the grip of the frailty of old age. Well, when Peter says to you here, keep going, endure your trials. Endure your trials by looking forward to this future prospect. He's not fobbing you off with some meaningless, unhelpful piece of encouragement like my teachers were when they told me to look forward to the Christmas party. No, he's saying one day God is going to repair that very body of yours that is presently suffering. That very mind of yours that is currently afflicted. And having repaired it, he's going to then make it unbreakable. I mean, that's a meaningful, helpful piece of encouragement, is it not? That logic is compelling. Unlike in my experience at primary school, for the Christian, tomorrow's party, tomorrow's resurrection party, really is an incentive to keep going with today's hard labor. We can humble ourselves under God's mighty hand, enduring the trials that God sends when we are eagerly expecting future glory. So the Christian endures trials and the Christian expects glory. But then thirdly, notice, the Christian entrusts anxieties. The Christian entrusts anxieties. So apart from waiting expectantly for eternal glory, is there nothing else that the Christian facing trials can do? Well, Peter tells us there is something else. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him. The Christian can do that. Suffering and trials inevitably bring with them anxieties. Thoughts like, how am I going to cope? What will this mean for my family? Will my faith in Jesus Christ be able to hold out? What will dying be like? Suffering and trials bring with them anxieties. And Peter is saying the Christian can entrust those anxieties to God. In practical terms, he's probably thinking primarily of prayer. That's the form that this entrustment takes. That's what Paul says, isn't it, in those well-known words in Philippians chapter 4. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. When our trials throw up all kinds of anxieties, we can do what we sang about a few minutes ago. We take it to the Lord in prayer. But we shouldn't skip over that word casting. The Greek term that Peter uses is quite a strong one. It's made up of a word meaning throw, with a prefix meaning upon, so throw upon. And the throw part of the word is used a few times in the New Testament, usually to denote a violent action. So guilt-ridden Judas Iscariot throws the 30 pieces of silver into the temple before going and hanging himself in Matthew 27 verse 5. In Luke 4:35, a demon who is being driven out of a man torments him one last time by throwing him onto the ground. In Acts 22:23, a Jerusalem crowd, enraged by words of Paul, which they consider to be the height of blasphemy, throw off their cloaks to express the intensity of their emotional fervor. In Acts 27:19, the crew of a storm-tossed ship desperately throw overboard the ship's tackle in order to lighten the vessel. And so you get a sense then of what kind of throwing we're talking about here. Once when we lived in Cambridge, I took the car to QuickFit to get some job done. And while the job was being done, I sat in the waiting room. And at one end of the waiting room then, there was the counter. And there were two doors into the room that were quite close to each other, one for staff that took you to the staff side of the counter, and one for customers that took you to the customer side of the counter. And at one point while I was there, a woman who was clearly very concerned about a number of problems that she had with her car burst into the room and started offloading those problems that she had onto a member of staff. Unfortunately, however, she burst in through the wrong door, which meant that she was on the wrong side of the counter, which meant that the person on whom she was offloading all these woes wasn't a member of staff at all. It was an ordinary customer who was standing there waiting to be served. And I've never seen anyone looking quite as bemused and taken aback as this guy, as this woman just launched into this monologue at him. But Peter is saying here that we can emulate that woman when we pray. There's a tension here, of course. I said before that humbling ourselves under God's mighty hand means we don't act as though God has got no right to send these trials across our path. We don't get on our high horse and kind of put God in his place. But nor do we go to the other extreme and think that our prayers have to be these very polite, diffident things which always involve at least 20 minutes of worship before nervously daring a petition or two. No, we throw our anxieties at him. Like that woman, we launch into them. The psalmists do that, don't they? Yes, you have psalms like Psalm 103 where virtually the whole thing is such elegant, worshipful stuff. But you have so many other psalms where right from the opening breath, the psalmist is launching into all the anxieties that are currently plaguing his life. And we too, like the psalmist, have the liberty to do that. That's what Peter is saying. It's not just a case of waiting expectantly for future glory. There's something we can do now. We can come and entrust our anxieties to God. So the Christian endures trials. The Christian expects glory. The Christian entrusts anxieties. But then fourthly and finally, notice with me this morning, the Christian engages Satan. The Christian engages Satan. We talk, don't we, about an army engaging the enemy. And in that sense, then, the Christian engages Satan. We all know that that's what verses 8 and 9 are about. That's the most famous part of our text. And we usually treat that part as fairly self-standing, and that's okay. I did so myself in a prayer earlier on this morning, and there's much truth just in verses 8 and 9, which is applicable in all kinds of situations. But verses 8 and 9 do belong in this passage. And let me explain the logic then. I think the logic here can be explained in three simple steps. First of all, entrusting anxieties, what we've just been talking about, entrusting anxieties is not an optional extra for the Christian. There are a couple of very interesting and very sobering touches in Jesus' teaching where he reveals that anxiety can be a discipleship killer. Most famously, the parable of the sower, or the parable of the seed. And remember the thorns, which just strangle, suffocate, smother the seed. And what are the thorns? Well, Jesus says in Matthew 13:22, as for what was sown among thorns, this is the one who hears the word, but the cares, but it's the word anxiety, it's the same word Peter uses here. The anxieties of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word and it proves unfruitful. He says something similar in Luke 21, verse 34. Watch yourselves, he says, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and cares. But again, it's the same word, anxieties of this life. And that day, that is the day of Christ's return, come upon you suddenly like a trap. And so in both those texts, anxieties are placed in quite unsavory company, with drunkenness and dissipation and coveting riches. Anxieties can swallow up a Christian's discipleship, a Christian's faith, can suffocate all the life out of a Christian. That is what Jesus is saying, which means then that what we've just been talking about, offloading our anxieties on God, that's not an optional extra, it's something we all must be doing. But then step number two in the logic. We will only do that, we will only entrust our anxieties to God if we are convinced of something. Namely, if we are convinced of God's concern, of God's interest. Remember reading the obituary of Sir Freddie Laker. Some of you will remember him. He was a pioneer in budget flying, low-cost airlines. And he died some 10 or 15 years ago. And I remember reading a story in his obituary. He was a wealthy man. And on one occasion, he noticed that one of his employees had a broken shoe. The sole had come loose from his shoe. And so Sir Freddie Laker pulled out a wad of banknotes from his pocket. And the employee was thinking, wow, he's going to pay for a fancy new pair of shoes. But he didn't. Instead, he took the elastic band off the wad of banknotes and gave it to him to fix his shoe. Now, a man like that is not a man who inspires you going with your anxieties to him. And if God is like that, if we think God is like that, then we're not going to go to him with our anxieties. So we'll only do this entrusting if we're convinced that God is a God who's concerned, that God is interested and willing to respond to our situations. So step number one, entrusting anxieties isn't an optional extra. Step number two, we'll only do it if we're convinced of God's concern. And step number three, Satan will therefore target our view of God. Satan will target our view of God. And he will try to make us think, no point in going to God. He's not interested. It's too small to take to him, this anxiety. No point in doing that. That's the intoxication of which Peter speaks. Because when he begins verse 8, be sober-minded. It's literally just be sober. And the word can mean then, don't be intoxicated by chemical intoxications. But it can have a broader meaning, and I think Peter here means, don't allow your minds to be intoxicated by that thought that God isn't interested. And so we have to engage then Satan. The Christian engages Satan. In the language of verse 9, he resists him. As Satan targets our view of God in order to stop us entrusting our anxieties to God, in order that our anxieties might be those thorns which suffocate all the life out of us, we must resist Satan. And three closing points of application then in this connection. Application number one. Store away in your minds Peter's one-liners here. Store away in your minds Peter's one-liners here. I'm thinking of two of them in particular. There in verse 7, casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you. He cares for you. Those four words, he cares for you. And then the other is in verse 10, that description of God, the God of all grace. I think Peter deliberately embeds within this passage these pithy sayings that we might store them away, because we're saying this is precisely what Satan's going to target. He's going to target our view of God. He's going to try and make us think that God is harsh. There's a wonderful section in John Owen's Communion with God where he talks about this, and he says that whenever we do sink into that thinking that God is harsh, Satan claps his hands. And John Owen says it always takes Satan back to his first triumph in the Garden of Eden. What was that triumph? He convinced Eve that God is harsh. God is trying to deny you something. He knows that if you eat that fruit, it will improve you beyond your wildest dreams. And he doesn't want that to happen to you. Satan has always been in the business of distorting the grace and the compassion and the goodness and the kindness of God. And so I'm saying, store away these two one-liners of Peter's. Remember, he cares for you. God cares for you. Remember, he's the God of all grace. Grace isn't some footnote to his character. It isn't some peripheral facet. Grace is his heartbeat. Grace is what courses through the veins of Almighty God. Grace is at the very center of his being. Remember these things. And when you're tempted to think, no point in going to God with my anxieties, remember he cares for you. Remember he's the God of all grace. So store away Peter's one line. As application number two, stick closely to God's people. Stick closely to God's people. Because it's very interesting, the precise wording of verse 8. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Someone. Singular. Peter doesn't say he seeks a crowd to devour. He seeks a congregation to devour. I mean, Satan, I'm sure, would love to do that. But strategically, he knows this is the best approach. Just as a real lion does. It looks for the weak, isolated animal that has been separated from the group, and it chases that, and it pounces on that, and it mauls that. So this lion, Satan, he seeks someone. He seeks the believer who has drifted from the group, who's isolated. And he thinks, I'll have far more chance of distorting that person's view of God than the believer who is constantly being encouraged and edified and pointed to God by his brothers and sisters. He seeks the isolated ones. And so stick closely to God's people. And that theme kind of pulsates through this passage, actually. It's the family motif. We look at verse 12, where Peter refers to Silvanus. It's interesting, Silvanus or Silas is everywhere else associated with Paul, but here he's clearly working with Peter, and Peter refers to him as a faithful brother, family language. Or again, when he refers to Mark in the next verse, he refers to Mark as my son, family language. And then when he tells his readers how to relate to one another in verse 14, he tells them to greet one another with the kiss of love, family gesture of affection. And Peter is saying then that you're at your least vulnerable when you're behaving familiarly, when you're at the heart of the people of God, when you're sticking closely. That's when your views of God are likely to be healthiest. Stick closely to God's people. And then application number 3. Beware a slightly different satanic assault. Beware a slightly different satanic assault. Because he's subtle, as we know. He's clever, this enemy. And yes, then, when we are suffering, he loves to distort our view of God. He loves to make us think that God doesn't care. He loves to put a question mark over God's character. But he might attack us by another route, which is this. Instead of putting the question mark over God, putting the question mark over us. Well, if you're suffering, can you really be a child of God? If you're suffering, can you really be saved? If God is letting this happen to you, in fact, if God is actually the one behind what is happening to you, then can you really be in the people of God? That's an alternative strategy he may use. Which is why I think Peter says in verse 9, resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. You see what Peter is saying? This is normal. Normal Christianity. No, this doesn't cast your discipleship into doubt because you're suffering. Christians everywhere are suffering. That's what Peter is saying. And then it's also why we have that crucial phrase in verse 12. By Silas, a faithful brother as I regard him, I have written briefly to you, exhorting and declaring that this is the true grace of God. What is the true grace of God? The grace of God that I've written about throughout this letter, which you experience amidst suffering, that doesn't sweep suffering away, that doesn't replace suffering, that doesn't eliminate suffering. The grace of God, which actually involves suffering now and glory only later. That's the true grace of God. The health and wealth preachers will say the true grace of God looks like living in a big mansion and having a fancy car and never being ill. I'm saying this is the true grace of God, hobbling along, beleaguered and battered and struggling as you await health and wealth in the world to come. That's when the glory will transpire. This is the true grace of God. Stand firm in it. And so, engage Satan, who doesn't want you to entrust your anxieties to God, who wants your anxieties to mound up and mound up until there's such a ceiling of them over you that you can no longer see God at all. Engage him. Resist him. Resist him when he suggests that God doesn't care. Resist him when he suggests that you can't be a true child of God. Endure trials, expecting glory, entrusting anxieties, engaging Satan. Amen.